Welcome to Outbeat Radio, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, we have Jamon Venerable as our guest. Yes. Jamon is 25 years old, native of Sacramento, California, is currently attending Sonoma State University, and is in the master's program in clinical counseling. His identity as a queer Black male therapist can provide both comfort and safe discussions of difficult topics surrounding his community.
In his personal life, Jamon enjoys the creative arts as well as having had some years acting within musical theater and straight plays. He enjoys listening to many genres of music from hip-hop and R&B to classical symphonies to alternative rock.
Welcome, Jamon. It's so nice to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, really. Thank you.
Stay tuned to learn more about Jamon. But first, here's news and events from Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Moralia.
I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of November 7th, 2021. Last week, the U.S. State Department issued a passport with an X gender marker, marking for the first time that a gender-neutral passport was issued in the United States, and sending a strong message in support of the rights of transgender, intersex, and non-binary persons. 15 other countries currently recognize some form of third gender marker in some way on passports. The countries include Austria, Argentina, Australia, Belgium, Canada, Colombia, Germany, India, Iceland, the Netherlands, Nepal, New Zealand, Pakistan, Uruguay, and now the United States. Jessica Stern, who's the U.S. Special Envoy to Advance the Human Rights of LGBTQI Persons and the former Executive Director of Outright Action International, announced the news on a press call stating that this action by the State Department fulfills a promise made by President Biden during his election. While only one passport with an X gender marker was issued that day, a routine rollout of the X gender marker is expected in early 2022, this after necessary administrative changes are made to relevant forms and systems. And thereafter, people in the United States will be able to self-identify as male, female, or X on their passports. And last Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear a challenge to a California court decision in favor of a patient who was turned away from a hospital for being transgender. Evan Minton was scheduled to undergo a medical procedure in 2016 at Mercy San Juan Medical Center in Sacramento, a hospital in the Dignity Health chain. 2 days prior to the appointment, a nurse called to discuss the surgery, and Minton mentioned that he is transgender. The next day, the hospital canceled the procedure. Minton sued, claiming unlawful discrimination under California's Unruh Civil Rights Act. In 2019, the California Court of Appeals held that Minton could pursue a claim for discrimination based on the hospital's cancellation of his surgery. The court also said that Dignity Health does not have a constitutional right to violate California's non-discrimination law. Dignity Health appealed, and last week the Supreme Court declined to uproot its ruling, stopping further attempts to authorize discrimination against transgender people under the guise of religious liberty. In June, the Supreme Court issued a unanimous decision in Fulton v. City of Philadelphia, in which the court refused to create a license to discriminate against LGBTQ people. And last month, we shared a story about North Carolina's Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, and the homophobic comments he made are in the news again. In the first incident, Robinson said that it was child abuse to force children to attend school where they be taught about, quote, how to hate America, or, quote, why they're racist, or transgenderism and homosexuality. He said, quote, I'm saying this now, and I've been saying this, and I don't care who watches it. There's no reason anyone in America should be telling any child about transgenderism, homosexuality, or any of that filth. And if you don't like me calling it filth, come see me and I'll explain it to you, end quote. But now, more recently, according to WNCT-TV, at a fundraising event for Republicans in North Carolina's Wilson County, Robinson doubled down on his statement, saying, quote, I believe that homosexuality is a sin. That comes from my deeply held religious convictions. But I also believe adultery is a sin and fornication is a sin. I believe putting pornography in a child's school is a sin, and I'm not going to sit silent while you put pornography in schools and present it to children," end quote. Governor Roy Cooper said it would be appropriate if Robinson left his position. The two were not elected on the same ticket. And Deputy White House Press Secretary Andrew Bates, speaking on behalf of President Joe Biden, called the words repugnant and offensive. And finally, Beth Johnson, a justice on the Vermont Supreme Court, was confirmed to the U.S. District Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, making her the first out lesbian to serve on any federal circuit court. The U.S. Senate voted last week 51-45 to confirm Robinson. President Joe Biden had nominated her for the position back in August. Her confirmation means that the Second Circuit will now have a majority of Democratic appointees. The circuit hears appeals from cases from federal courts in New York, Connecticut, and Vermont. Robinson has a long record of human rights work. As an attorney, she was co-counsel in the Baker v. State case that resulted in the 1999 Vermont Supreme Court ruling that the state must grant same-sex couples the same rights as opposite-sex couples. For a calendar of LGBT events happening here in the North Bay, go to gaysonoma.com. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Maloney. I'd like to change the world,
but I don't know what to do. And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diane and Sheridan. As our guest tonight, we have Jamon Venerable, who is 25 and studying to be a therapist. He is Black, male, and queer. Thanks again for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us in the studio tonight, Jamon.
Thank you so much for having me. It's definitely an honor to be here.
So I'm excited because I just recently met Jamon at Sonoma State University at the Black Student Union. I went to share my play that's upcoming. So it was really nice to meet you, Jamon, and to learn about you a little bit. So I would like to know, we want the audience to know more about you. So that's why we brought you on. So tell us about how is it at Sonoma State and how long you've been there and how is it for you over there?
So I had just started my semester, my very first semester here in August. And it's a clinical counseling program that I mentioned earlier. And it's been a bit of a whirlwind. I'm not going to lie. You know, it's definitely daunting coming from undergrad, but I've gained a lot of skill and knowledge and met a lot of great faculty at Sonoma State that I was not expecting, but am 100% privileged to have. It's definitely shown a lot of possibility for me as a therapist in the future, and specifically benefiting communities within my own sections, like being a Black man, but also being a queer man. I could find a lot of skills that are useful from Sonoma that are really beneficial now to me. So,
well, that's positive. So the daunting part, is the daunting part that like the homework or what's the...
The daunting part is the homework. It's a lot of the homework. It's a lot of over analyzing your thinking and constantly communicating with your peers and just having to navigate that whole process of being very exploitive of the material, and it picks at your brain a lot more than undergrad. But I love that. That's what I love about the job. That's what I love about the career I'm getting into. You can really focus on the details of a person, of what they're going through and how they're navigating life, and hopefully benefit them in your skill set. So I'm really finding myself in a positive light being in the program. But yes, again, the homework is daunting.
Wonderful. We're curious to know how did you find your path to become a therapist and really wanting to work with Blacks and queer LGBTQ plus people?
So I had a pretty rocky start of my early life, and I knew that there was a lot of things that were definitely not benefiting the way that I probably should growing up. And it took me a while to really acknowledge that. Just coming from a family where we all supported each other in multiple ways, even through the hard times, it still showed that I was willing to be a help to somebody else who might be in that same situation. When it came down to family arguments or things like that, I realized that we weren't finding the best ways of communicating that. And I think being in this program, I got really comfortable getting familiar with communicating better with people and understanding where they're coming from. And I think overall that can help me benefit other people also in ways that I probably wasn't benefited in the past. So I think that for me is a really big stepping stone as to why I'm in the program and why I'm choosing to focus on helping others with all types of skills.
I think that's really extraordinary because a lot of people would maybe have a similar story where things aren't the best in the home life and stuff, but they don't go be a therapist. So
right.
What is it about you, and actually Diana, what is it about you that gives you that yearning to help other people versus being your own, doing your own life and not worrying about other people?
Right. I think for me growing up, knowing the issues and the struggles that I was dealing with within the family, within myself, understanding my own queer identity, I was finding myself having a hard time talking to other therapists growing up because they were either not identifying in the way I felt I could be benefited. I was seeing a lot of white therapists. I was seeing a lot of therapists who may not have understood my gay identity or my queer identity. And it was just a struggle for me to really try to find somebody that was able to really help me in those aspects of my life. And so I think overall, the representation for me is a really big thing. And to also keep in mind, I am the only Black male in my cohort. And that already signifies a lot. It does feel like a lot of pressure in some ways, but at the same time, I don't see it as pressure. I do see it as more determination. And I think that's the thing that I'm really looking into.
As Cher was speaking to you about your desire to help, and similar to what my journey was like, because I got my master's as well from Sonoma State University. And as a kid, I saw in my family too, like Jamon, like you're saying, like, the picture, you know, the way they were communicating was not okay. And I wanted to do something else. And then also being the only one in the program. So I want to just encourage you to, you know, stand strong and be yourself, be your authentic self. Let them learn a lot. You could teach them a lot about you and, you know, your journey and for other Blacks and people of color.
I do have a question about that, what Diana just brought up. How is it for you to be the only Black? Are you the only man?
I am not the only man, but I am the only Black man specifically.
Yeah. So curious how that is for you in a therapeutic classroom where everyone is supposedly into transformation and putting humans first and the heart and everything. Where does racism come in? And are your classmates aware of it? And how do you navigate that part of your program?
I have definitely noticed how my classmates are acknowledging the fact that, you know, there is a racial factor to counseling and we have to respect all types of people and multiple identities. And being a Black man in the program and having these conversations with white peers or non-queer peers, it really kind of dissects us a little bit and kind of shifts us to either understand each other's narrative in a little bit more. And I think for me, I was always looking in my perspective in one way, but I think at the same time, I could also learn from people who aren't like me as well. And sometimes people in my cohort are willing to have those conversations, but a lot of times it could be a bit difficult to kind of bring that subject into the open air without feeling like you're hurting anybody or making them feel less than. But we are all respectful of one another's identities and where we come from. And so we try to bring up a lot of multicultural factors whenever we're in courses, whenever we're talking about subjects that are pertinent to the material, basically, which makes me feel better as a Black queer man, because at the end of the day, we're going to be dealing with all types of people. So I'm grateful to know that we're actually having these conversations in the courses that we need to, because it could have been completely different.
Yeah, that's wonderful that that's happening. So Jamon, I'm curious about your family and how they're feeling about you in this field of study, because you're going to be analyzing them, you know. I know they made some jokes about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, you're right. I have my family has known that I've wanted to do this for the last few years, the last couple of years now. And so seeing it come into fruition for me and for them, it really makes them feel a little joy and spark of progress and just our whole community. I always tell people, this degree was never for me. This degree was for so many people. And my family is one of definitely those people also. And I can understand that at the same time, because my family did have some difficulty in terms of understanding mental health and how to navigate that within the family, I can see how there's some tension when we're discussing certain things regarding mental health. And I bring up topics regarding mental health that they may not understand, but I think just overall having the conversation and throwing it out there is already a start. And as if my family can really see that I'm doing the work, and they do, it just makes me push harder. And so they really are my rock. And I really, really am going through this program because of them. So.
Wow. Beautiful. Are they learning anything from you?
They're learning. they're learning as much as I guess I'm giving them. The only thing is it's because of the distance. You know, I'm here in Sonoma County, and they're, you know, a lot of my immediate family is in Sacramento, but I also have some family in Berkeley as well. And so I do keep tabs on, you know, on them from time to time. And whenever I find time to give out some information whenever I'm back home, but I figure it's best if I really just kind of hone in on my skills and not kind of force the skills onto them, because I don't want to lecture them. I want it to be natural and just show them that I'm actually doing something, but they know that I'm making progress. They're just always making sure that I'm keeping my head straight.
I can feel the connection, the closeness that you have with your family.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a closeness from a lot of stuff that we've gone through, but it's beautiful, you know, end of the day.
How did they handle it when you came out to them, or have you come out to them?
No, I have come out to them, and this coming out was around 13 years old, and it was definitely around the time where I was definitely discovering myself and knowing exactly what I thought I was attracted to, and getting very comfortable with being attracted to those particular people. And so I was raised by my grandmother and my aunt, and those two women to me were immediately accepting and immediately loving of everything about myself, and have always known that I was different. When I was 7 years old, I performed in a musical in Sacramento at one point, and for a gift after I was done performing, they gave me like the head of a doll, basically. And I was like, oh, I mean, this is unexpected. I was seven. I was just enjoying the moment. But in hindsight, it really showed that they really knew who I was, and they really didn't care what I enjoyed or didn't enjoy. They just wanted to make sure I was safe and happy and proud of who I was. And I think that to me is such a blessing, because that's just not common that I hear in a lot of people's stories, you know, coming out and growing up. So I am definitely appreciative. And I felt really comfortable once I turned 13 to come out. And it was just absolute love. Just absolute love.
I keep saying, wow, I love these stories, you know, because you're right. We don't get many of those where family members are just so accepting.
Right. And I'm, like I said, I'm grateful for it. And being Black, again, I had to kind of keep that same aspect on top of my queer identity as well. And that was always something that I had to like kind of figure out, that power balance or that dynamic as well growing up. Because as much as I loved being queer, I loved being Black. And sometimes those things kind of mesh, and I had to try to navigate those things growing up as well. And it took some time to really figure it out, you know, whether I felt more comfortable being one or the other. But over time, I definitely gained more comfortability in both. And I acknowledge that full-heartedly to this day.
Can you say more about that? Like an example of the conflict that you were having around your Blackness? And
yeah, I mean, I grew up in a pretty predominantly white area in Sacramento, and Elk Grove was a definitely less culturally diverse, but still accepting of all types of people. And I was grateful for that. However, I noticed that if I, you know, was more comfortable hanging around folks of color, people who were Black, I was having a hard time expressing my queer identity to them sometimes, because it was almost as if you were in this one section of your life and you can only live that particular life if you're with those people. However, I never really grew up and understood my queer identity until I turned 18 and started going to community centers in Oakland and Sacramento, and really just understanding more of my queer identity through community centers. But growing up, going through high school, going through community college, it was definitely a struggle figuring out why I couldn't fit in with Black folks in certain ways. And so I had to kind of take into account of whether my Black identity was actually valid, and why it was valid, and who actually validates that. And I think at the end of the day, I realized I validate that. And I choose to validate that. And nobody can choose whether or not I'm Black enough, or I'm queer enough, or I'm not queer enough, or I'm not Black enough. I had to really take a stance on what my values were. And I think the stance was just ownership of myself, ownership of my life and what I plan to do in the future. And none of that involves anybody else. And I really do sit with that, and I'm proud of it. I guess that's why I'm in the program I am. Yeah,
that's where it starts, is from yourself. They want you to be a certain way. And so you decide, you know, we all have to decide who we are and what our values are. And so you did that.
Thank you. Yeah. Again, I still find times to this day where I know I can maybe feel one way or another, but I know at the same time that all of my identities are all intersectional. And that's the beauty of who I am. So I just have to love myself.
So where do you get your strength from, Jaman? Your strength and your wisdom. Where do you get that? You have mentors around?
I have mentors. I have family members who are much older than I am who have given me the strength. My grandmother gives me a lot of the strength. My sister gives me a lot of the strength. And my aunt, for sure. But I cherish a lot of the people that I meet just through my daily life. I enjoy talking to people, and I get very comfortable expressing who I am. And so I think a lot of people see a lot of potential in me wanting to, you know, be more of an outspoken person to multiple people. And as I was growing up, there were people saying, oh my gosh, you're so outspoken. Like, you should become like a priest. You know, you should become like a... and at the same time, I understood what they meant by that. I didn't grow up religious, but I understood what they meant. They said that it seems like your voice has a following. Mm-hmm. And I really respected people when they said that, because it just showed that it made me feel like I had more potential than I thought. And I took that to heart, and I really grew with that. And so I think being in a program like this for me was a huge benefit to just my open expressiveness and my opportunity to just be real and be authentic. And I think that comes a lot from family, because we have a lot of big personalities in our family. Yeah.
So you mentioned your sister.
Yeah.
Is that, you have one, how many siblings do you have?
I have officially, there's about six of us, but I do have one blood relative, and that's my sister, Miche. And Miche, she's 1 year younger than I am. She's also a graduate and has her BA as well. And she's also going through a master's program in Africa starting next year.
Oh.
Yeah. And I think that's something that me and her are both really excited about. She is definitely someone that I really do lean on. And I can see how she carries herself in certain ways that I maybe not carry myself, and vice versa. She's going to school for social work in her master's program, and I'm going to school for clinical counseling. But we both have the same goals, and that's to build our communities up. She identifies as a queer Black woman, and I identify as a queer Black man. And we both see how there are similarities and differences, and we respect each other as much as we can, even though we are still siblings and we still want to hate each other. But I do really find her such a fascinating, loving, gifted, strong woman in my life, because she does so much to really benefit so many people. And I just look up to her, even though she's my little sister. I really do.
That's really great that you both are in the same kind of field, really, you know, with people, you know,
yeah.
Care about people.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that you want to go and work with your community. And thank you for that.
No, thank you. I think that it would be a huge benefit to see, again, the representation. My sister wants to have that representation on the front. I want to have that representation on the front. Again, I think it just starts at a certain point. If somebody can really put that out there and show that, that gives other people a chance to really try and do the same thing, because you never know. You never know unless you really try to make that effort. So
I'm sitting here listening to you and really loving what you're saying. The point that you said about other people seeing something in you and said, oh man, you should be a priest. And what they saw in you and how you said you weren't religious, but you found this niche for yourself in psychology and wanting to help people, being a therapist. And I just think that is so fabulous because you are giving yourself a platform. It's just not the platform the people who recognize this in you thought of, but you went and did something that you're comfortable with, right, that you can help your community and anyone who wants to come and learn from you. Mm-hmm. You've put yourself out there. And I'm thinking you might just want to have your own radio show or your own podcast or your own YouTube channel or something, because, you know, you have so many wise things to say, and it's another way of reaching out to people. I keep getting on Diana to do that as well. Maybe you guys could do it together once you graduate. Yeah. And you don't have school to worry about, because that's a whole lot. That's daunting, all the homework and papers and everything.
Yeah.
But I just think it's terrific what you're doing, what you're saying, the type of person you are. I'm really thrilled to meet you.
I'm just curious about talking more about you going in the field of psychology. I know you talked a little bit about your family upbringing. So was it mostly about your being Black and queer? I'm just looking at that part, that, because, you know, we all go into psychotherapy for, you know, for reasons. I'm just curious.
Well, right.
Can we like pull that apart a little bit?
So for me, I realized that psychology was a great way to kind of explore my own battles that I was struggling with growing up in terms of my family upbringing and how tumultuous the relationship with my mother was to the relationship to my grandmother, to the relationship to my aunt and my father, and seeing how those dynamics really affected me as a child. It really pushed me into really understanding that as I got into the field of psychology. I wasn't aware that these things were going to come up because I kept them so underground and buried, but I got a chance to really open and ask these questions to myself. I got a chance to open up and ask more questions as I got older to my family. And I got to really understand just more of how these relationships came about growing up, because at the same time, as much as I love my family, I know that there were things that I wish I could have understood more. And sometimes that's just not necessarily the route I could. Let me reel back. So in my family, there were things that I know had happened and I was aware of, but at the same time, I still didn't have all the details growing up. I understood that, I respected that, but I was always wanting to find out more and more and more. But I also realized doing that could just kind of hurt me at the end of the day, you know, trying to find all of these details about my life and trying to navigate like who's right and who's wrong and what's going on and what's not going on. It kind of put me in a mental state where I didn't feel like myself. I felt like I was living other people's lives and trying to navigate their lives and see why they were doing certain things. Now, when I got introduced to psychology, I was grateful because I got a chance to introspect. I got a chance to really look at how all of these things were affecting me specifically, because I was so used to wanting to just kind of give other people their reasoning as to what's going on with them. But I never really got the chance to introspect myself growing up. Thankfully, once I got into psychology, I really, really pushed that introspection and that self-growth and that desire to really learn more about myself. And once I got to a point where I felt comfortable enough, I thought, okay, well, if I feel comfortable enough to really explore myself, I would hope to feel comfortable enough to get others to explore themselves also. And I figured what better way to do that through counseling.
Yeah. So are you, Jamon, in relationship with your bio parents? Do you?
I am in a relationship with my mother. I have been on and off with her in terms of relationship wise, but right now everything is pretty stable. My father did pass away in 2001. He died at the hand of a cop. And this was definitely before all of the protests and everything that happened, that's happening now and has happened over the last, well, over the last few years, in media wise, because this has been happening constantly. So he was just a part of the bunch that, you know, just didn't have social media at the time. It was 2001. And so it was a big hit to our family, and we understood that, and we all grew from that. We all found ways to really try to bond with each other and understand that at the end of the day, you know, no one's life should be taken for granted, and that we should all love each other just as much, if not even more. And I think that that's the thing that bonded us the most is the sad fatal death of my father.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking if you're very, very young. What? How old were you?
I was about 5 years old, yeah. And my sister was about 4. And this was all happening while we were just in the house. It was all happening while we were sleeping. We didn't really know exactly what was going on. We didn't have any idea what was going on at the time. As we got older, we got more information from different family members. And so we put all the pieces together and we kind of figured out, this is really what happened to our father. And this is really what's affected our family in a lot of ways. But I think the beauty of it all was getting connected with family members in ways that I didn't expect to, because they would reminisce about my father constantly. And they would find things that they would remember about him and find things that they would cherish about him and bring back those memories that I never actually got a chance to see. For me, that was the blessing that I feel like I've always had, was the love of my family, and the knowledge that they have of my father is always something I can always carry with me.
So yeah, thanks for sharing that. Sorry, so sorry that tragic happened. You know, it's very tragic. And you're so young and missing your dad. Yeah.
Yeah, I do find times where, you know, I do think about him, and I wonder how that plays into my role as a counselor, as a future therapist, and seeing how that could either help me or hurt me. Because at the end of the day, I wouldn't want any of these memories coming up in sessions, or I wouldn't want any of these reoccurring things to pop up where I'm trying to counsel or help other people. And so that's why I think for me, going through psychology and understanding myself, having my own therapist even, gave me the opportunity to really look at this situation that has happened in my life, especially at a young age, and seeing how it's affecting me now at 25. I think for me, it's the benefit that I can, if I can really understand this and understand how it's affecting me, I can let these things manifest as what they are and hopefully it grow from that as well.
Wow. Okay, so
it's about time for our music break, and you brought a song, so we'd like you to introduce the song, why you brought it, and what it means to you, and then who you have singing.
So the song that I brought to the show today is a song from 1983, definitely before my time, but it's a very important song to me, and it's called Ain't Nobody by Chaka Khan and Rufus. And the song to me signifies so much about my strength as a Black queer man, but also so much love that I've gotten from my family. And I know that when I listen to the song, I reminisce about the memories and the joys and the love of being around my family, dancing around my family, and just expressing my identities full-heartedly. And that's something that I feel like I find in the song. That's something I feel like I would hope anybody would find this song, is that expression of freedom.
So take a listen, everybody. Chaka Khan, Ain't Nobody.
Yeah.
Thank you.
was Chaka Khan singing Ain't Nobody, the song that Jaman brought to share with us tonight. And if you just joined us, Jaman is a 25-year-old black queer man pursuing a career in psychology at Sonoma State University. We join the interview as Diana is asking Jaman about the QSA, which stands for Queer Straight Alliance.
The QSA at Sonoma State, are you involved there?
I am involved. I had a little bit of hesitancy, I'm not going to lie. For me, there was a lot that I think I was hesitant about being a Black gay man going to Sonoma State, specifically going to the QSA meetings. I was told and was aware that these meetings were mainly queer white people. And I had no problem with that. I understood that that was the thing, but I still decided to go, even though there were things that people were saying, you know, about the meetings and stuff like that. I still decided to give my own perspective. And once I got there, I actually got a chance to really talk to people and really get my own identities represented. And I think that's the main thing that I got from it, was the joy of just talking to people. I mean, we're all queer folks. We just may have different skin, and that's perfectly fine. And I felt really comfortable once I got really acclimated. And so I'm grateful that I'm actually able to be a part of QSA.
Wonderful. And so being a part of the Black Student Union, how is that, and how is that supporting you in this majority white school?
Yeah, it's giving me a lot of comfort being in the BSU. There's so many people, so many young Black people, and it's funny because I am one of the older Black men in BSU, but I see so much potential by hearing what they say, hearing what we talk about and discussing these topics that I knew all of my life, but I never really had a chance to really talk about, you know, in a group like this. And so I was so grateful to walk into a community of Black students who are really trying to benefit their lives through education, and just seeing all the potential that we all have. To me, that just shows so much positive growth. And I'm just so excited for the future, for the Black future particularly. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, my short time there, I loved it when I was there with y'all. So I just really appreciate you and appreciate all of them and what you all are doing and thriving for, really supporting Black communities and Black people in general, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there is a small amount of us on the campus, and I understand that. We all acknowledge that. But I think that's just what makes us stronger. It's just the fact that we're, you know, there's not much of us. And so we're doing our best to always just check in with each other and care for each other when we need it, and know that we're not alone, you know, at the end of the day.
Thank you so much for being our guest tonight, Jaman. And we're wondering if you might have some words of wisdom for our listeners. You're so wise. What words can you leave them with?
Yeah. I'm thinking in terms of advice that I would say to always give yourself time to heal from hurt. There is a lot of things that I think we go through as a society, as just people, that we try to either navigate through just going to work, going to school, doing this, doing that, and trying to keep our hurt kind of in the back burner, just to put a metaphor on that. But I can see how hurt can affect all of us. Giving ourselves time to heal from that in whatever capacity that can be really gives us a chance to really look at it and really grow from it and really expand on it and ask why we're hurting and how we're hurting and what we can do about it. Because I think at the end of the day, once we can acknowledge that, we can help benefit the people around us. I think that's the beauty of learning to take time to heal. And so that's the advice I would say.
Wow. Thank you so much for being here. I want to ask you so much more. I want to ask you about that little boy who was at 7 years old in the musicals, you know, and you're doing your thing. And yeah. So I know we're out of time, but
yeah.
And I want to know about the doll head.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
There's definitely some stories I can give y'all about that.
Well, maybe you can come back sometime. Maybe, you know, we'd love to have you back, Jamon.
Maybe you and your sister, we can have you both come in. Yeah, that would be fun.
Oh, my. Oh, I know she would love this. It would be such, we would have such a hoot.
All right. Well, we're going to make a date with you and your sister to come back.
I'm looking forward to that.
And, you know, she can join us on Zoom from Africa. What country will she be in?
She'll be in South Africa. She'll be in Pretoria. And she'll be studying out there. Yeah. So I'm really excited for that. Yeah.
Excellent.
Wow. Cool. Well, thanks again. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate this opportunity to really just open up and really, so I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And that interview was taken with Jamon earlier this month. And we have a second segment for you. Dr. Diana Grayer will be our guest. Yes, your co-host and my wife, Diana Grayer. And Diana, when Jamon was talking about being the only African-American in his cohort, I was wondering if you could share a little bit about your schooling as far as being the only African-American in your programs as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my experience when I was at San Francisco State and also at Sonoma State and in my PhD program as well. So I can relate to what he was talking about as far as the isolation and not being connected. I didn't have at the time a Black Student Union. I didn't think those things existed back then when I was in college, or I didn't even think of researching it. But I doubt if we had those kind of support systems.
Remind the listeners when you got your BA, your master's, and your doctorate.
Well, a long time ago, okay, in 79, 93, and 2010. Yeah, but I'm a strong individual, and thanks to my mom that I was able to manage myself really well during those awkward times with being the only person of color, pretty much. Meridian, I was able to connect with a couple people of color there. But before, at Sonoma State, not at all. But I had several friends at San Francisco State because I played basketball and I played softball. So we had people of color there. So that part was good. So I really enjoyed the conversation we had with Jamon. And I love the fact that he's taking his knowledge and taking it home to his family. And that's what we're supposed to do. When we go out into the world and we learn something that we want to share with our families to advance them, because I'm the first one in my family to graduate with my BA. And then I went further on to graduate school. And so I'm the only one in my family. And then recently, I have other family members who are starting to get degrees, which is wonderful. But yeah, I really respect that Jamon is doing that to help his family be better in the way they communicate. And I love the love that he shared with his family. So yeah, and I love that he's doing the Black activist thing. You know, he's stepping up and he's being a Black proud man and a gay guy. It's wonderful to see.
I agree. It's really nice to see somebody so young, 25 years old, and able to have a vision of the future and how he wants to help other people navigate their families and the way they communicate within their families. It's really terrific that he took that time and is taking the time for so much introspection.
And so it leads me to talk about my play this weekend.
Say more.
Well, anyways, my journey has been as a therapist, helping people, educating people. And so I do that in my practice. But as you know, I see 1 to 4 people in my practice. And I've always wanted to do, I feel like my messages are larger and should be spread wider to a wider audience. So that's when I decided, it just naturally happened, to start writing plays so I can give out messages to people and to educate people based on what I've learned in my own private practice, seeing so many different clients over the last 25, 30 years. I have a repertoire of knowledge, and I want to help more people. And so my plays have been so valuable in that. And I get to talk about issues that people don't like to talk about, really, to put on the stage.
Like what?
Like my first play, Private Lives, Private Lies, is about stories, short stories about the LGBTQ community, how they suffer, how they're rejected, how they're discriminated against. And so I put that together and produced it, directed 8 times. And it was a beautiful journey for the people, the participants, and the audiences. And so I also did a When the Bud Blooms, and that's about depression. So I like to talk about those topics that people are not talking about. Last year I did a play, Shattered Dreams, and you participated in that one, Cher, and that was wonderful. It was a social justice, injustice kind of play where a black person went for auditioning for a play, and then a white person auditioned for a play, but you know, the white person got it, even though that person wasn't as qualified. So I wanted to show that discrepancy, how whites and blacks are treated. And also this recent one, this past weekend, was really, really incredible. It was a short play, and it's titled Pictures Don't Lie. And this is a really important play because it was a contest from Upstage Napa Valley. And I love the prompt. And it was about 2020. And we know how terrible 2020 was for everybody. Devastating pandemic, Black Lives Matter movement. So much was going on. So many deaths. Such pain and isolation for so many people. So the prompt was conversations after. And the most significant thing that popped in my mind at the time was the comparisons of when the Black Lives Matter movement took place, and they had rows and rows of National Guard standing by, and Black Lives Matter protesters was just walking for their lives, right, protesting against injustice. And the insurrection happened, and I could not believe watching the news and seeing the people climb the Capitol and just the chaos, and the National Guards weren't called in. And I just sat there looking at the news, and I was just crying because I knew that if the tables were turned, blacks climbing the walls, we wouldn't even made it up the wall. They would have been shooting us. It would have been a massacre. It would have been awful. So I wrote this piece, Pictures Don't Lie. And I love the prompt, as I said. So I submitted my piece. I think I wrote that piece in 30 minutes. So I wrote the piece and I submitted it. And I wrote the producer and I said, you know, I don't think you are courageous enough to produce this, because I just couldn't believe they would do it in Napa. But I was surprised. 2 days later, she said, we would like to do it. And this past Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon, incredible feedback from the audience, because we have, after each little short play, we had talkbacks. And the talkbacks were incredible. People want to talk about race. We need to do more. I want to do more. So I am creating more. I have short plays. I'm going to do a black production. And I'm going to do it like a workshop or a participatory type thing, so people can talk about race. Just to have an open discussion. Just to have a place. Because Cher, you were there. You witnessed Friday and Saturday talkbacks.
What I was really blown away by was your play was the last of three. And after each play, there were each about 15 minutes, the audience would have a talkback, like you said. Mm-hmm. Yours was last. And so people could have left and gone home, and not one person left. Mm-hmm. And they were all such in rapt attention as far as wanting to know what they can do. That was the overarching question, mm-hmm. that I think each audience had. The theme of each audience was, what can we do? That was almost all white. And I think another theme was, thank you for bringing this to us, Diana. We need more of this,
yes,
in our community. Mm-hmm. Because Napa does have a reputation for being very white. And I do remember seeing maybe one or two people of color in the audiences during the various evenings that your actors were performing. But I think they were surprised. I think they were pleased and surprised, and I feel like they got educated. Mm-hmm. Because in our society, we don't really see two black men talking. In the media, we see a lot of cursing, violence, gangster stuff, weapons, but we don't see two men just talking, and that's what they were doing. And I think the audience really appreciated that, and they may have learned something like, wow, people can just talk and have a conversation. They don't have to beat each other up. So I was really, really pleased with the turnout of a full house every single night, even though we have a pandemic. Everybody was masked up and mm-hmm. had to show their vax cards. And I think they really, really celebrated you. A lot of people came and asked you for your autograph. And I think your actors learned some things as well.
Yeah, I think so too. But yeah, you're right about what can I do? And that's a couple lines that I put into the play. I wanted them to be able to think of that. But here's this black guy saying he can't sleep at night because he's thinking about activism. Like, what can I do? And I had him repeat that twice and slower. What can I do? And so that, you're right. It's interesting how everybody, that became the theme of what people say, what can we do? What can we do? And I didn't want to make it a workshop at the time, but we did offer a few things. Like, for instance, I say, what we're doing here is we bring in this to your attention so you can see the different layers. Because we talked about COVID. We talked about just the relationship with, you know, you have a friend who's sick with COVID. You know, what do? You have a person who may be the potential of being shot because they're black. And people are not reaching out to them. White people are not reaching out, saying, checking in, you know. Same thing with the Asian, when the scare, when they were getting hurt and violated. Sure, I never forget that story you shared with me when you were at the post office. You checked in with the Asian woman and say, you know, I'm just checking in. Sorry about what's happening. And that is such a difficult thing for people to do in our today's society, to check in on each other when the potential for danger is there.
I think people are so shy. They don't know what to say. They don't know how to say it. They don't know how to approach you if you're a stranger. They don't have any friends of color, and so they feel stuck. So your play will have such ramifications of opening up the floodgates of, just like you said, sitting there and talking about it is a first step. You have some plans for your play. Why don't you talk about that before we go?
Well, I plan to produce it for sure. I'm going to add a few more pieces to it. And I would like to have opportunities to have people do some writing and talking and just make it a big deal. Like, let's talk about race, you know? And I want to do the same thing with my new children's book, Kina's First Speech. Our blackness will never fade. I'm working on workshops for that for teachers, an addendum to go with the book for teachers, and also a curriculum for college.
That sounds really exciting. I mean, you are a true activist in my eyes, because you aren't just sitting there saying, what can I do? You're putting all of your knowledge and your passion inside your characters, and then they are the voice of what you feel.
They deliver what, exactly. I have so many good short pieces. It's like now the decision is which ones I'm going to put together for this endeavor that I'm looking at. I'm calling it a black production, but it's something to do with race.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be continued, and we will check in with you every once in a while on our show and see how things are going, and you can talk more about it. We do have to end, though, tonight.
Yeah.
Really want to thank you for imparting some of your wisdom with our listeners and tagging on to Jaman's interview. So is there anything, any last words you want anyone to know?
Yes, I just want us to be open to one another. I want to teach. I want to educate people about race. I want people to overcome their fears. They talked about that in the talkbacks. The fear stops them from reaching out. They want to. They have a desire to. But that keeps us all in this stagnant place.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. keeps us stagnant and not moving and not connecting. So, yeah, reach out, talk to each other, and be open.
Thank you, Di. We want you to remember, like Jermon and Diana, you too can be living proof that through sharing your story, you can help make other people become aware of the road you travel, and perhaps you can make it an easier road for others to walk. You can help us make this world a better world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we will be back next month. Until then,
good night.
I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my way. Can't stop me now. Then you can.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County, with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Rohnert Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Beale Street Caravan is next.